This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
Hello, and welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Willa Johnson. In this episode, we bring you two stories highlighting how the economic decline here in eastern Kentucky is being talked about at a national level. Then, in honor of Black History Month, this episode wraps up with a third in a six-part series from Michael and Carrie Klein, exploring the history of desegregation in Mount Hope, West Virginia. It's been 2 years since President Donald Trump took office. Since then, he's claimed credit for a coal comeback. But Brittany Patterson of the Ohio Valley Resource reports that federal data about the industry tells a different story.
The coal industry and its out-of-work miners have been important symbols for Trump. But as Brittany Patterson reports, after 2 years under Trump, more coal power plants are closing down and coal employment is at an all-time low.
To talk about coal, President Trump likes to come to the Ohio Valley. Here he is speaking at a November rally in Huntington, West Virginia.
We've ended the war on beautiful, clean coal, and we're putting our coal miners back to work. That you know better than anybody.
But federal data tell a different story. Preliminary figures for 2018 show fewer than 81,000 people were employed by mine operators and contractors. That's a record low, and about 1,000 fewer than were employed by coal in the last year of the Obama administration. Industry analysts say Trump's looser environmental rules have not helped.
So we had some pretty significant regulatory rollbacks in 2018, including the replacement of the Clean Power Plan with a new rule by the Trump administration.
That's Trevor Hauser, a coal analyst at the independent research company Rhodium Group.
2018 was a record year in terms of coal plant retirements. So we're closing more coal plants than we ever have in the past, and there is no indication on the horizon that any utility in the country is planning on building a new coal-fired power plant, even under the current, more relaxed regulatory environment.
Here in the Ohio Valley, Utility First Energy Solutions declared bankruptcy. Then it announced it would close two coal-fired power plants, one in Pennsylvania and one in Ohio. Another of its plants in West Virginia will close by 2022. Another major utility, American Electric Power, announced it was moving up the closure date for one of its Ohio coal plants. These closures mean there are fewer places to sell coal burned for electricity. That concerns Jason Bostick with the West Virginia Coal Association.
If you look at the share of where the coal was headed, the domestic utility market for West Virginia coal continues to decline, and that's extremely concerning.
Nationwide and here in the Ohio Valley, the amount of coal mined dropped to the lowest level in nearly 40 years. Coal exports, however, were up, specifically the kind used to make steel. The industry calls that metallurgical, or met coal for short. In places like West Virginia, overseas demand for met coal pushed production up.
Thank heavens for an increased domestic steel industry and a whole lot of international coal exports.
To meet that demand, some mines, especially in West Virginia and Virginia, have reopened. Federal data show West Virginia mines added a little over 500 jobs in 2018. Tom McLaughlin trains coal miners in Northern Virginia, where some met coal mines have ramped up production. He says he's been busy since Trump took office.
Well, as soon as Trump got elected, it was like somebody taking the finger out of the dam. There was all kinds of activity, including especially the training, and it's held up fairly well since.
But even in West Virginia, where things have looked slightly better for the industry, there were also some high-profile mine closures. A mine in Wyoming County shut its doors in October, putting about 400 miners out of work. And there's a lot of indications that that international demand for met coal, especially by China, is cooling off. Here's Hauser again.
2019 We have some pretty troubling signs about the outlook for the Chinese economy this coming year, and that could take the wind out of the sails of the metallurgical coal market pretty quickly.
It's possible that West Virginia's bounce in production could be a brief one. Elsewhere around the Ohio Valley, coal employment has been stagnant at best. Ohio mines added just 16 jobs last year, and Kentucky lost almost 400 jobs. Retired Kentucky miner Larry Miller says that doesn't surprise him. He says he never thought there was anything Trump could do.
So it's a matter of economics. I don't think it's sustainable. And I really don't think that the EPA, the relaxing of the rules might help some, but I don't think it's the main driver for the job loss.
Miller worked for more than two decades underground and says he made a good living. But he says he's seeing firsthand that coal is no longer an economic source of electricity. For example, near his slice of western Kentucky, a group of utilities is installing a large-scale solar farm.
I think coal is pretty much, it's not going to be gone, but it's not going to be the economic engine that it once was. And I made a good living in coal for a long time, and I liked it, so I don't take pleasure in saying that.
The U.S. Energy Information Administration recently adjusted down its coal forecast. It expects coal production to hit a record low in 2019. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Next up, WMMT's Sydney Bowles brings up a story about an Eastern Kentucky addiction recovery program that has been selected to take part in a national study. The study explores best practices for programs working to support low-income families in finding and keeping employment.
Researchers with the U.S. Department of Agriculture have selected an Eastern Kentucky addiction recovery program to participate in a new study. The study hopes to learn what kinds of programs help people in addiction get back on their feet. It's called Building Evidence on Employment Strategies for Low-Income Families, BEES for short. The idea is, we need to know what kinds of programs really help people find jobs so the federal government can fund programs that work the best. Addiction Recovery Care is one of the first of up to 21 programs to be selected for the study. I spoke with two of the study's researchers to learn more. So, could I get you both to introduce yourselves? Give me your names and what you do.
So I'm Karen Martinson, and I'm a principal associate at Apt Associates, which is a social policy research firm. And I'm based in Rockville, Maryland. I'm kind of the lead on the Kentucky site right now.
So I'm Dan Bloom. I'm a vice president at MDRC, which is also a social policy research organization. I'm based in New York City.
Could you sort of give me the 101 about what this project is and what it aims to do?
So the purpose of the BEES project is to try to build evidence about effective strategies for helping to improve employment outcomes for low-income people in the U.S. And so the project funded MDRC and our partners like Apt Associates to look around the country and find innovative employment programs targeting low-income people and to do rigorous evaluations of those programs to see if they're effective. The general goal of the study is to identify programs and models that are effective in improving employment outcomes for disadvantaged people. And then I think there's sort of two things that can happen with that. One is that the programs themselves that are effective can sometimes get, you know, more funding or be able to expand to serve more people. But also the project generates general lessons that could hopefully apply in other places. So that policymakers know what's effective and are hopefully willing to, you know, spend public dollars on things that actually help people. If we're spending public dollars on things that are not effective, the people that, you know, suffer most from that are the participants in the studies, I mean, in the programs rather. And if we can direct public dollars toward things that are effective, we both, you know, it's better for taxpayers and it's better for the people that are participating in the programs.
I'm really curious about the framing of the project. It kind of talks about employment and economic security as two separate things. And I wonder if you can explain how you think about those two things as different.
I mean, I don't think we think of them as necessarily different. It's just that employment is for this population in particular, it's an important step on the route to economic security.
Yeah, I think there's also a goal of trying to reduce people's reliance on various kinds of public benefits, which they wouldn't need as much if they had steady employment.
And so the program that I heard of you all through is Addiction Recovery Care here in Eastern Kentucky. So if the program is primarily about finding, or the study is about finding programs that help people find and keep good jobs, can you articulate your interest in including addiction recovery programs in that?
Sure. I think, one thing about BEES is that kind of when the project kind of started, I think you saw that we're focusing on different target groups, different, you know, types of kind of low-income families. But I think because of the opioid crisis going on in the country, there was a focus on finding programs that help people with substance abuse disorders improve their employment outcomes. So we were particularly looking for programs that provided treatment as well as employment services. So we were kind of doing a national scan on that, in that particular area, and that's how we found ARC. And I think the reason that it's a strong program for this study is that it combines the treatment and recovery and employment and housing services kind of in one program.
You know, there is a theory out there that integrating employment services into treatment can bolster the effectiveness of the treatment itself. The employment services kind of almost become part of the treatment. And so I think that's one of the things we're testing in this study, because as Karin said, they're not often integrated in this way. And I think, if programs like this have good results, I think it could have big, implications for the substance abuse treatment field.
One of the real challenges in this part of the country, especially for folks coming out of addiction, is that there are just genuinely fewer jobs than there are people. You know, a lot of the counties in this region are labor surplus areas. There just aren't jobs. And the jobs that there are frequently, the hours are irregular, they don't pay very well. And then if you're trying to get back on your feet and find housing after addiction, that's another layer of difficulty. I don't know, I guess I'm curious about how you are thinking about those sort of external circumstances when you look at analyzing a program's performance.
Well, I mean, the way we typically do evaluations in a project like this is that, we use a design called a randomized control trial. And the idea of a randomized control trial is that it's sort of the same way that we test, that the new medicines are tested or something like that. The idea is that there's a random assignment of individuals to receive a certain set of services or to not receive those services. And what we're looking for is whether the individuals who receive the services do better than those who didn't. And so the fact that the labor market is weak in a certain area, certainly true, and it's certainly a challenge, but it's that would apply to both of the groups. So really what you're looking for is, despite all the difficulties with the labor market, can the program, through its services, help people do better than they otherwise would have done? And in this case, we wouldn't be doing a random assignment to receive the basic treatment services, but some of the supplemental housing and employment services are the things we would be testing, and Karin can go into that more. But no question that the lack of employment opportunities is a big challenge for a program operating in that environment. But we're testing whether it does better than people would have done without those services.
I mean, I think they have also kind of a waiting list, but they have, more people that want the services and that can you know, they have room in their housing facilities for, so it kind of creates a natural environment to do a study like this. I also would say that, you know, ARC, one reason we're interested in the program is that they do really try to improve the employment prospects for families by, you know, they have, you can do internships at the, you know, at the homes, they have jobs in the facilities. So we're trying to look at whether, how that changes the kind of the earnings trajectory compared to like kind of some of these other employment issues that the families face, or the individuals would face if ARC wasn't there.
Absolutely. And can you talk about how ARC fits in with the other programs that you are, that you've chosen for the study?
Well, I have to say ARC is one of the first programs selected.
So then what's the timeline look like?
It's kind of a, so we're selecting programs like kind of on a rolling basis. So I think we'll probably be selecting programs throughout 2019 would be my guess. And the total number, we're not exactly sure. There'll be a, you know, a decently large number of programs. We're not exactly sure how many because it depends on, you know, the cost of each of the individual studies. But yeah, I would say over the course of 2019, we'll be selecting programs, and the study length will be a little different from you know, program to program, but several years long for each one.
You know, we're going to study people as they go through the program, so, and we track them, you know, for a couple of years, if not longer, because it, I mean, it takes a while for people to go through the treatment and recovery, and then get the services, and then kind of move into the labor market. So we will be tracking that whole period. And I think our client, the Administration for Children and Families, is really interested in getting information out to the field, out to program operators, out to policymakers. You know, they really want a study where people are going to use the results to improve policy and practice. And they don't want a study that sits on the shelf, so there really is a big effort when the results come out to get them out to those who can use them.
Yeah, those are kind of the questions that I wanted to ask you. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't? Anything that you would want folks in Eastern Kentucky to know about what you're embarking on?
You know, I think ARC seems to us to be a very, you know, strong model. That's one of the reasons that we wanted it to be in the study. So just that, you know, people should know that there's some innovative, potentially strong programs operating in their community. You know, we don't know yet whether it's gonna, you know, how the study will come out, but based on what we've seen and from looking around the country, it's I think a promising model. Would that be fair, Karin?
Yeah, I think, you know, there aren't a lot of programs that kind of combine the treatment and the employment services together. I mean, there's kind of more standard, not standard, but, you know, treatment facilities. And then there's also kind of the, you know, employment system that does, you know, provides education and training and things like that. But this program is unique in that it brought it together. We don't know yet if it will work, but... you know, that's why we were very interested in ARC. And I also just want to give ARC some credit for, you know, participating in the study, because they've been really willing to, you know, work with BEES and be part of BEES, because they really want to learn, too, if their program works, and that's been really important.
I think we've done it. Thank you both very much. Have wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Have good weekends.
Have a good weekend.
Yep, you too. Bye. Bye. For WMMT, I'm Sydney Bowles.
Last in this episode of Mountain News, we bring you part 3 in the Hope series, produced by Michael and Carrie Klein for Talking Across the Lines. In this piece, Nathan Shelton and Brenda Jackson describe their experiences with racism in the 1960s at Mount Hope High School in Fayette County, West Virginia. Then, Shelton, Jackson, and Eleanor Agee discuss the ways in which interracial families have always been a part of the fabric of West Virginia.
Do you want peace? Do you want to be right? Do you want love? Or do you want to fight? Do you want to celebrate? Or would you rather have an altercation? Do you want to build?
And now, Hope, Wit and Wisdom on Race, Class, and Community Survival, brought to you by Talking Across the Lines, the Mountain of Hope organization in Mount Hope, West Virginia, and by the West Virginia Humanities Council. Based on Coalfield memories, the ones that tear you up and the ones that feed your soul. Here we are again at the corner of race and class, watching the world go by and listening for commonality among Coalfield voices. Brenda Hyman Jackson came to tell about an experience she shared with her brother. The two Hyman kids had been attending a weekend singing conference hosted by Mount Hope, the massing of choirs from several communities to make a joyful noise. During a break in the afternoon singing, students crowded into a local joint for refreshments and a chance to unwind together. The jukebox was playing their favorite tunes from 1963.
Love you.
And suddenly, the urge to dance in a room full of cheerful visiting students overcame Brenda and her brother, an urge that outweighed the customary restraints, which deep down, they knew all too well.
We were having a choral festival. Our school was hosting it, and there was a little place where kids could go and dance. They had a little jukebox, and so you could go in and put money in the jukebox and dance, but the black kids were not allowed to dance. You could put money in and listen, but you were not allowed to dance. My brother and I thought we were quite the dancers, you know. And this was back during the time when everybody was like American Bandstand. So everybody was dancing. And so we decided that we were going to dance. Now, did we know that we were not supposed to? Yeah. Did we think we were going to do it anyway? Yes. What got into us? I don't know. I mean, I think we just thought, well, it's a choral festival and all these other people are here from other high schools, you know, other little towns. So we're just going to do it. And so we took ourselves out on the floor and we started to dance. And the person who owned the little place came and unplugged the jukebox. So for the rest of that weekend, the kids were not allowed to go to that place. But when it comes to talking about open rebellion or something that you're going to do that you know wasn't sanctioned or it wasn't okay, I think that was probably the one thing. And my brother and I did that. And we just thought, let's just do it and see what happens. And I guess somehow we thought that because there were other people there, they would say, okay, which is crazy to think that.
Young Nathan Shelton was caught off guard by race-based restrictions. As a burn patient for most of his 7th and 8th grade years, he had spent 19 months in the segregated ward of a local hospital. Released finally with extensive skin grafts, he emerged on the opening day of 9th grade at Mount Hope like a newly uncaged creature, starved from social deprivation during his lengthy hospitalization and ready for engagement in a newly integrated classroom.
Ninth grade, Mount Hope Junior High School. My first time ever going to school with white children. And I fell in love with a white girl. I'm 15, 16 years old, ninth grade. And back then, you know, we would pass notes. You know, you didn't have the text and all that that they have now. You'd write a note, and I had a special way I would fold it, you know, to make it look like an envelope. And I think that the letter was one or two paragraphs, something about I admired her and she was very pretty or whatever. Nothing vulgar, anything like that. That would have been the period right before lunch. So when that class ended, I passed her the letter, the little note. And at the beginning of the period right after lunch was my art class. My art class, that was Mrs. Gardner. And suddenly I heard my name announced over the loudspeaker. First time I ever heard my name on a loudspeaker. Nathan Shelton, come to the office immediately. I didn't know what immediately meant. So I asked Mrs. Garden, I said, immediately? I said, what does that mean? She said, that means right now. You know, get your things and go down and see what he wants. I had never been to the principal's office. Get to the principal's office. He's sitting behind his desk. And he says, sit down, Nathan. I sit down. And he says, Nathan, this is almost verbatim. I can never forget this. It's the law that colored and white go to school together. That's the law. And it ain't nothing I can do. And he banged on his desk. There ain't nothing I can do about that. And then he went on to say, but I am not going to allow any colored boys to be sweethearts with white girls in my school. And then he showed me the letter. I don't know how he got it, but he had the letter that I had written her. That was a Monday. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And he said, Nathan, I'm going to have to suspend you. He said, I don't want you back in this school until next Monday. 4.5-day suspension.
You know they call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. Mm-hmm. And Wednesday's worse, and Thursday's oh so sad.
And this was the worst part. I got a letter cut in all of my grades. That was the first marking period. Kept me from making the honor roll. He was the principal at Mount Hope Junior High School. I just had to stay out of school for the whole week and got that letter cut. The cut in my grades is what really got me. I mean, it was like, wow, why even work hard to make good grades? I never made the honor roll after that. I didn't even try. I just wanted to make sure that I had enough to pass. And I was not a dummy. I was much smarter than a lot of kids in my class. I had the exposure at the hospital, which I was around professional people, doctors and nurses and whatnot. But anyhow, that was really probably the worst thing that happened to me throughout my 4 years at Mount Hope High School. One thing that I really firmly believe this, when my generation, our generation, when we're gone, then that's going to be the last of the prejudice to disappear. Now, when I first came back home from New Jersey to West Virginia, I couldn't believe that. Black guy walking up the street holding hands with a white woman, and they got 3 or 4 kids with him. That's a family.
West Virginia, you have a lot of people who were marrying, you know, blacks and whites.
Eleanor Agee.
My grandmother was Caucasian and Cherokee. So people mixed, and they loved, and they had families, and they all got along fine, as far as I remember.
I see it more in West Virginia. I mean, it blew my mind. And it's a good thing, because we're all God's people. We all got red blood in us, and if you needed some of my blood, I could give it to you. I could take your blood and make it work in me. I know for a fact because it's happened to me.
You've been listening to Brenda Jackson and Nathan Shelton, Mount Hope High School class of 1966 in Fayette County, West Virginia. And Eleanor Agee, a graduate of the all-black Stratton High School in Beckley in Raleigh County.
Do you want peace? Peace, peace. Do you want love? Love, love.
Our Hope theme song, Do You Want Peace, was composed and sung by Laura Sandage and friends on her Bloom CD. Additional music was performed by Nathan Shelton. With a taste of Mary Wells for old time's sake.
Some other girls are filling your head with jive.
This program program was written and produced by Talking Across the Lines, with direction by the Mountain of Hope organization in Mount Hope, West Virginia. Executive producers are Reverend Charles McKinney and Jack Spadaro. This project is presented with financial assistance from the West Virginia Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations do not necessarily represent those of the West Virginia Humanities Council or the National Endowment for the Humanities. For Hope, I'm Carrie Klein.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News. Music on this episode features Pigmeat Jarrett with a tune called Thundering and Lightning off the album Look at the People, which was recorded at Apple Shop's own June Apple Records. Pigmeat Jarrett was born in Cordele, Georgia in 1899 and lived as a child in Rockhouse, Kentucky in Pike County, where his father worked as a coal miner before his family later settled in Cincinnati. He passed away in 1995. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, you can find them on our website at WMMT.org or download Mountain News as a podcast from SoundCloud or Stitcher. I've been your host, Willa Johnson, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.